good morning and welcome everyone to Live Dharma Sunday for April 15th, 2012. Koyo Kubota here. Glad you joined us. You know, I'm thinking about this spring weather we're having, and it's different than last year. Last year was very wet. This year was very dry. This year we've got some heavy rain that came later, but it still didn't make up for the dry winter. And I was thinking, every spring is unique. Every spring's different. Just like I remember when I was writing about sunrises, when I went for sunrise walks by the lakefront. Every sunrise is unique and different. Then I said, well, of course, every moment is unique, even though in a sense it's the same, right? Well, it's another day, but each day is a new day. Now, we have to be able to appreciate that. Otherwise, we'll think that every day is just another old day. But that's part of it. The unique, absolute value of every moment, every person, every event. I don't know how to better elaborate on this, but there's something there. Well, let's begin today with our guest. We're giving our Dharma glimpse, Andy Goyal of New Jersey, part of our Lay Minister 4 group. And so without further ado, Andy Goyal Sensei.
Well, good morning, everyone. Good early morning, California, a little bit later here on the East Coast. We're trying to have spring here. Got up to 70 or something yesterday. We're waiting for it to be real serious. I thought I'd reorganize and read my glimpse relates to my morning meditations. As part of my morning meditation, I recite the Buddha's last words. Of course, these are likely not his last words, but something close, perhaps. And as I get into the issue a little more, there are many variations in what his last words were supposed to be. I'd like to focus on one part. That's, quote, after I am God, the teachings will be your guide. Be true to yourself. Those who practice my teachings and live by the teachings are always with me, close to me. But even though one is beside me, if he does not practice the teaching, he is not near me. Variations include from Stephen Batchelor's translation, condition things break down, tread the path with care. Musong translated part of the last words is, be an island unto yourselves, fare forward with apamata, diligent care. Another translation was, condition things are perishable, with vigilance, strive to succeed. And one more translated by Philip Yampolsky. After I have gone, just practice according to the Dharma in the way that you did on the day that I was with you. Even though I were still to be in this world, if you went against the teachings, there would be no use in my having stayed here. As I've noted previously to this group, I'm an ardent behavior analyst, one comfortable with looking at behavior as part of a phenomenological world. I speak and study the contingent nature of things, including what we do, and the composite nature of things, including who we are. Without impermanence and interdependence, there'd be nothing interesting to study, nor would life be of any interest either. So when I think about either Buddha's first talk describing the middle way, its eightfold path and the four noble truths, I'm encouraged to stay focused on what we do, not only what we believe. There is no variation of, quote, believe in me and all will be well, have faith in me, or what I believe and all will be well. There are constant reminders from beginning to end on what we should be doing. The one who does not practice the teaching, not can recite the teaching, knows the teaching, believes in the teaching, that one is not close to Buddha. Practice according to the Buddha, to the Dharma, whether the Buddha is in the room or in the world, is irrelevant. Tread the path, walk the walk, do the deeds. That is what all Dharma leads to. All my isolated sitting and meditation are useless to me and to the entire community. It does not lead me to behave in ways that bring me closer to the Buddha. For some, going to a nice B&B in the hillside may be restorative and refreshing. For me, the B&B is Buddhism and behaviorism. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much. As I listen to the Dharma Glimpse, I have to share that Andy was a graduate student at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, where I was teaching in the psychology department. And this goes back over 30 years ago. And we reconnected. And part of our program, you know, the reinforcement contingencies, how we learn things, and the behavioral approach to behavior change. You know, when we want to change ourselves, we want to be a certain way in the world. How do we, well, of course, if you're working in the helping profession, how do you help others to change their behavior? Maybe it's parents working with autistic children, or how does one use behavior modification techniques on oneself? Sometimes, of course, you know, the principles are the same. And just because you know the principles doesn't mean that you can apply them to yourself. But of course, if you do know the principles, you should have a head start on applying them to yourself. Okay. Now, I think in one sense we could say that Buddhism is very much common sense. It has deals with cause and effect. This is another phrase for, in Pali, the ancient Buddhist language, the Samu Praktipitta. I can never pronounce that word correctly, but it means dependent origination, or it means interdependency, cause and effect. The very broad use of the term karma. Karma means action. You do something. And then, of course, something happens. Okay? This is where Andy Goyal is coming from. He says, well, you do something, and spoken words is also behavior. And the classic illustration, if you want to influence somebody's verbal behavior, just nodding and giving attention when someone's talking, and if you do that, make your nod contingent upon certain category or type of words, such as verbs or nouns, you could increase the frequency. And the other person doesn't even know they're being conditioned. The laws are there. Of course, if you are aware of the contingency or the link, it'll be even more effective. Or maybe not, if you were trying to produce some opposite effect. And I this brings back some memories to me in my beginning of my career as a being in the field of psychology and in the general area of learning, right? What is called operant learning. Operant means how the organism operates on its environment. Voluntary behavior, as opposed to, say, conditioned fears or something like this, so-called classical conditioning. So our voluntary behavior, our everyday behaviors, how are they formed? How are our habits formed? How are our usual routine ways of doing things? To really look at the contingencies, see? What happens after you do something? Or even this, what is called discriminative stimuli, that is, in the animal research, if a pigeon pecks a lighted disc and then he gets food, he'll start pecking that disc. Common sense. A discriminative stimulus says, if the disc is green and you peck it, then you're going to get food. But if the disc is red, no use pecking because you won't get food. Okay. So first you teach them to peck the thing, then only peck it when it's green. So if you're a situation could be a discriminative stimulus. If you speak in a certain way to a formal audience, you know you're going to get rewarded in a certain way, and you should behave in a certain way. But if you're in with your friends drinking beer, you would also talk in a certain way. You wouldn't talk in a formal sense. You say, hey, what's wrong with you? Relax. See? These are things that are so much common sense, we don't have to be aware of them. We learn this is the way to best function in the world. Now, when we think about this, we think about it as samabhakti, or in Japanese Buddhism, it's called innen. Innen means causes and conditions. There's a direct cause, and the conditions might be equivalent to discriminative stimuli. Now, as I thought about early in my career in psychology, how close the behavioral laws were to these, what we might call spiritual common sense. And I remember my next door neighbor in the office area in the psychology department, Rick Shull. I was talking about this to him, and he said, he knew of a professor at the University of Arizona, or maybe it was Arizona State, called Verhaf. And Professor Verhaf just offhand briefly talked about this connection between the Buddhist principles and philosophy and behavioral laws, how similar they were. And he called himself a Skinnerian Buddhist. Kind of neat. I always remember that phrase. And of course, Skinnerian Buddha means, Skinnerian means B.F. Skinner, who was the champion of reinforcement and contingency operant learning laws. And also, it's interesting, when I wrote to Professor Verhaave. I wanted to, you know, get a little background information about this, and I shared this, and he goes, yeah, that's right. That's my phrase, Skinnerian Buddha. And, but he also, in his letter, response letter, he said, but you know, in the discipline or the field of psychology, academic psychology, my advice is don't publish anything along these lines. He didn't elaborate on it, but it's true, because when you think about religion and science, there's something very deep antagonism between religion and science. And it comes in the West because of the whole history of Galileo and organized religion, church, power struggles, the politics. So scientists do not want to deal with that kind of blind faith, emotional, devotional responses that characterize the usual stereotyped idea of religion. And this bias is so strong that if you talk about psychological matters and color it with anything to do with religion, all the academic circles will shun you or look at you with a, you know, skeptical eye. And it's going to take a long time before that kind of antagonism is tempered or modified, because I think Buddhism is still not really understood in general. It's categorized as a religion and all that goes with it. And this is where I, you know, PR or public education, it's going to take a long time before it gets down to the masses of where people really say, oh, because religion usually always means deity. Blind faith in certain beliefs, all-powerful gods. And if that is the definition of religion, then we could say in a sense that Buddhism is not that kind of religion. It has to be redefined. You know? And yet, of course, in the usual sense of the word, Buddhism is categorized as a world religion, a major world religion. So this is sort of a fuzzy aspect in terms of what is the label. The ism, Buddhism, Protestantism. Buddhism doesn't believe in those kind of isms. So the label is problematic. And it behooves us to, if we, as Buddhists, socially or in a presentation, we have to know the general frame of reference that the non-Buddhist audience may be coming from. This brings to mind an everyday example. There was a Buddhist, and her name was Nancy, American Caucasian lady, and she worked in her workplace. I think it was a lunchtime conversation, and they were talking about astrology, and they were kind of questioning something. They wanted some information about something. Well, what does astrology say about this? Blah, blah, blah. They didn't know. And then one of them said, well, why don't you ask Nancy? She's a Buddhist. You see, kind of public image of Buddhism being out there, weird, esoteric, in the same basket or category as astrology or superstition or something like that. I think it will take a lot of... I remember also another example would be when Mayor Harold Washington, the mayor of Chicago, he passed away in 1988. He had a heart attack in office, and it was a big shock, sudden. And the city mobilized, and they had a public memorial service in Daly Center Plaza downtown. And it was an interfaith service. So I was asked to represent the Buddhist community, and there was each person, minister, representing the different religions. We had, you know, like a 2 minute, say some words. And the MC, he introduced, and now representing, you know, Buddhist community. And now this is a throng of people that are gathered in the Daly Center Plaza for the memorial service. Good assumption that they were not Buddhists. The general public. And you could hear a reaction when the moderator announced me, a Buddhist representative. The Buddha? Like, Buddhist? What's going on here? Who's this? You know. But I looked regular. I didn't even have a shaved head then. Dressed in a suit. We were not robed up. I could speak English. This is something very basic in public relations here. And the image of Buddhism, public image of what a Buddhist is. Okay. Oh, they never saw a Buddhist before. Buddhist clergy. Hey, speaks English. And then what I said, I quoted some words from the Dhammapada, and I could feel the change in the energy that what I said they could relate to. You know? I said, hey, this guy's saying something that's insightful and that's supportive and that's good about human life. Life's truths and realities and so forth. And then, of course, with the Dalai Lama being having such a presence and media coverage, and when even Kung Fu, David Carradine, that kind of mass media impact on society is tremendous. When movie stars come out, Richard Gere and so forth, it makes people relate to Buddhism differently, to open their ears and their minds a little bit and to see what it's about. And it's a very slow, broad process we're talking about here. You know, the whole framework. And I remember at a conference, it was in Cleveland, part of the Eastern District. You know, there was New York, Toronto, Cleveland, Seabrook, New Jersey, Chicago. We have our Eastern District of the Buddhist Churches of America. We didn't belong to that organization, but they were our, well, we could say cousins. And so we joined in fellowship, and we took a turn in hosting every Labor Day weekend this Eastern District Conference. And, you know, they traveled, and each location takes their turn. So with Cleveland's turn, they organized a conference. And each conference has a theme. And this theme was, they had, how do you come to Buddhism for non-Buddhists? And they had a panel of about 8 people, all Caucasian, and all Buddhist. And this is a Buddhist conference. Okay. But my point is, when each one said, well, how I came to Buddhism and then, you know, what their path has been. But they said, I started out, what got my attention in the beginning was to watch that David Carradine in Kung Fu. The kinds of verbal expressions and viewpoints that he expressed. And then the second person said, oh, I had a similar experience. And then the third and the fourth and the fifth, about 90% of them said, hey, and they were surprised. They didn't know this about each other. Hey, I too. That's what first caught my attention. This shows you the power of the media and of how that program, you know. So I think when we talk about the impact of the teachings, even before that, we have to think about outreach, or what I might call PR or public relations, and so forth. And as usually when ethnic Buddhists, someone's in a social situation, someone might say, oh, you're Buddhist. What do Buddhists believe in? They don't know what to say. They're not very articulate about it. And there are various reasons for that. One is because it's not something where you can say 1, 2, 3, or like the Bible, here's this, or, you know, here's the word. Because Buddhists do live their religion. It's not something they believe in, and, oh, here's the belief. So it's difficult. But coming from a different place, frame of reference or assumptions, well, oh, Buddhists, what do Buddhists believe in? That's the first question. And it's an inappropriate question. It's not a fruitful question. It's a question that if you answer, it'll be misleading. Okay. And yet at the same time, we have to be able to somehow articulate that gives them something where they could go forward from it and be educated. Hey, I didn't know that. Otherwise, they think that, oh, we believe in Jesus and the Buddhists believe in Buddha. They pray in the name of Buddha. We pray in the name of Jesus. They see it. That's the only frame of reference the non-Buddhist, say, or Christian has. Okay. So there's a long road ahead of us. And it's okay. It's okay. Okay. But psychology and the behavioral laws, this is why sometimes people say, well, Buddhism is really for the educated. College educated, say, that class of people, because they're not as likely to be as superstitious, in a sense. You know, a lot of the masses of people are still believing in astrology and superstitious behavior and so forth, and fortune telling and everything else. And we have to realize this, that as Buddhists, we may be of a very limited, smaller subpopulation of the people that are higher educated. I'm not meaning to talk down about less educated classes, but we have to be aware of how to communicate to these masses of people. Okay. And this is where the challenge is in America. And psychology is a tremendous gate. Thank you very much. That's all for today's broadcast. Till next time, you keep going. And until then, you have a very beautiful, contingency-laden day. Thank you.